A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a good one. He points out that we all think, but most of us spend almost no time thinking about the act of thinking itself. What even is a thought if you try to define it? How many thoughts do we have in a day? And what does the science actually say about the idea that our thoughts lie to us, and that learning to control them might be one of the most effective ways to live a happier life? I like this. It's one of those questions where the more you poke at it, the stranger it gets.
It really does. And the first thing I did when I saw this prompt was go looking for the numbers, because I remembered there being some headline figure about thoughts per day, 6,000 thoughts per day. That number gets thrown around constantly.
I've seen that. Also seen 60,000, which is a pretty wide margin of error.
Right, and here's the thing. I dug into where these numbers come from, and it turns out neither of them has any real scientific backing. They seem to have originated from pop psychology books and then just spread through repetition. The actual research is much more recent. There was a study published in Nature Communications in 2020 by researchers at Queen's University in Canada. They developed a method to measure what they called thought worms, moments when a person transitions from one thought to another. They used fMRI to watch brain activity patterns shift and identified what they called thought transitions. Their estimate came out to about 6,200 thoughts per day.
The pop psychology number accidentally landed in the right ballpark, just without the methodology to back it up.
But what's more interesting is what they actually measured. They weren't counting discrete thought units, like 1, 2, 3. They were identifying transition points where the brain's activity pattern shifted significantly enough to indicate a new topic. It's more like measuring waves than counting marbles.
That's where the definition problem comes in. What even is a thought if you try to pin it down? Is the feeling of hunger while you're reading a thought? Is the background awareness that your chair is uncomfortable a thought? Is the split second of recognizing your brother's voice before you process the words a thought?
This is where neuroscience and philosophy collide productively. If you ask a neuroscientist, they'll describe a thought as a pattern of neural activation that represents information, a physical event in the brain. A cognitive psychologist might say a thought is a mental representation, a unit of cognition that can include images, words, sensations, or abstract concepts. A philosopher might point to propositional attitudes, beliefs, desires, intentions. Mental states that have content and direction.
None of those definitions fully overlaps with the others.
No, and that's productive tension. But for what Daniel's really asking about, the most useful framing comes from cognitive behavioral therapy literature. In CBT, a thought is typically defined as something that passes through your mind and can be put into words or images, a cognitive event you can, in principle, notice and describe.
That's already a narrowing. You're excluding the background hum, the thing where you just sort of know where the door is without thinking about it.
Right, and that's intentional. CBT is interested in thoughts that have emotional consequences, the ones that trigger feelings and drive behavior. And this is where we get to the second part of Daniel's question, the idea that our thoughts lie to us.
Which is a pretty bold claim if you haven't encountered it before. My thoughts are lying to me? I'm the one thinking them. How can they be lying?
This is one of the core insights of cognitive therapy, going back to Aaron Beck's work in the 1960s. Beck was a psychiatrist trained in psychoanalysis, and he started noticing something while treating depressed patients. They weren't just feeling sad, they were having streams of automatic thoughts that were systematically distorted, thoughts that popped up unbidden and shaped their emotional experience, but that the patients themselves hadn't really examined.
Give me an example. What does a distorted automatic thought actually sound like?
Beck identified a bunch of categories. One is catastrophizing. You make a small mistake at work and the thought that flashes through your mind is, I'm going to get fired. My career is over. Another is mind reading. You assume you know what someone else is thinking without evidence. My boss didn't say hello this morning. She must be angry with me. Another is all or nothing thinking. If this presentation isn't perfect, I'm a complete failure.
I've definitely had some of those. The mind-reading one especially. It's almost hard to catch because it feels like perception. You're not thinking she must be angry with me. You just feel like you know she's angry with you.
That's exactly the problem. These thoughts feel like facts. They present themselves as observations about reality rather than interpretations. And that's what Beck meant when he talked about thoughts lying. The thought presents itself as truth, but it's actually a distorted interpretation, often empirically false.
The therapeutic move isn't to stop having thoughts. It's to learn to recognize them as thoughts rather than as reality.
Beck called this collaborative empiricism. The therapist and patient work together to treat thoughts as hypotheses rather than facts. You examine the evidence. You test the thought against reality. And this turns out to be remarkably effective. There have been hundreds of randomized controlled trials on CBT. It's one of the most thoroughly researched forms of psychotherapy, and it consistently shows effectiveness for depression, anxiety disorders, PTSD, eating disorders, even chronic pain.
I want to push on something, though. The phrase, our thoughts lie to us, is catchy, but it's also a little misleading. A thought isn't an agent with intentions. It's not trying to deceive you. It's just a pattern that your brain produces.
That's a fair point, and even CBT practitioners would agree. The lying metaphor is pedagogically useful, but not literally accurate. What's actually happening is that our brains evolved to prioritize certain kinds of information processing that were useful for survival, but aren't necessarily optimized for accuracy or happiness.
The brain that's constantly on alert for threats and social rejection probably passed on more genes than the brain that was calmly accurate about probabilities.
This is the evolutionary psychology angle. Our cognitive biases aren't bugs. They're features selected for in environments very different from the ones most of us live in now. The negativity bias, for example. We pay more attention to negative information than positive. We remember criticism more vividly than praise. A single hostile comment can ruin a day that included dozens of positive interactions. From a survival perspective, this makes perfect sense. Missing a positive opportunity is disappointing. Missing a threat can be fatal.
The brain is essentially running threat detection software written for a world of predators and tribal conflict, and we're trying to use it to navigate email and social media.
That mismatch creates a lot of unnecessary suffering. This is where the third part of Daniel's question comes in, the idea that learning to control your thoughts can lead to a happier life. I think the word control needs some careful handling here.
Because the instinct is to think of thought suppression. Just don't think about the bad thing. Push it away.
That doesn't work. The research on thought suppression is really clear. Daniel Wegner did the foundational work in the 1980s. He had people try not to think about a white bear for 5 minutes, and they had to ring a bell every time the thought came up. The bell rang constantly. And then when he told them they could think about the white bear, they thought about it even more than a control group that had never been asked to suppress it. This is the rebound effect.
The classic don't think about a pink elephant problem.
When CBT talks about controlling thoughts, it's not talking about suppression. It's talking about cognitive restructuring. You notice the thought, you examine it, you evaluate its accuracy and usefulness, and then you either accept it and let it pass, or you actively generate a more balanced alternative thought.
It's more like editing than deleting.
There's a newer set of approaches that take this further. Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, or ACT, developed by Stephen Hayes in the 1980s and 90s, takes a somewhat different approach. Instead of challenging the content of thoughts, ACT teaches people to change their relationship to thoughts altogether.
What does that mean in practice?
The idea is the suffering often comes not from the thought itself, but from fusing with it, taking it literally, treating it as a command or a truth. ACT uses techniques to create cognitive diffusion. You learn to see thoughts as just thoughts, mental events that pass through awareness. You might practice saying to yourself, I'm having the thought that I'm worthless, rather than I'm worthless. That tiny linguistic shift creates a surprising amount of distance.
It's almost like you're adding metadata to the thought, tagging it as a thought rather than experiencing it as reality.
That's exactly the mechanism. And the research on ACT shows it's particularly effective for conditions where thought challenging can sometimes backfire, like chronic pain or anxiety disorders, where the person already knows their fear is irrational but feels it anyway.
You've got CBT on one side saying examine the thought and correct it, and ACT on the other saying step back and observe the thought without engaging with its content.
They're not necessarily contradictory. A lot of modern therapists integrate both. If someone has a thought that's factually distorted, you might use cognitive restructuring. If someone has a thought that's technically possible but unlikely, and they're stuck in a loop about it, you might use diffusion techniques.
Let's talk about the evidence base. You mentioned hundreds of trials. How effective are we actually talking about?
The effect sizes are meaningful but not miraculous, which is what you'd expect for something as complex as mental health. For depression, CBT typically produces medium to large effect sizes compared to no treatment, and it performs about as well as antidepressant medication for moderate depression. The combination of CBT and medication tends to outperform either alone for more severe cases. For anxiety disorders, the results are even stronger in some cases. CBT for panic disorder and specific phobias has some of the largest effect sizes in the entire psychotherapy literature.
There's been some debate in recent years about whether the effectiveness of CBT has been declining over time. I remember seeing headlines about that.
There was a paper that got a lot of attention suggesting exactly that. A meta-analysis that found effect sizes for CBT for depression appeared smaller in more recent studies than in the early trials from the 1970s and 80s. But the interpretation is contested. It could be that the early trials had methodological issues that inflated effect sizes. It could also be that CBT has been so widely disseminated that it's become harder to find pure control groups. When CBT principles are everywhere, in self-help books, apps, popular media, the control condition isn't really no treatment anymore.
The baseline has shifted. Everyone's getting a little bit of CBT, whether they know it or not.
And there's also the issue of therapist quality. As a treatment spreads, the average quality of delivery might decline if training standards aren't maintained. CBT is a skill. Doing it well requires training and practice. Just knowing the concepts isn't the same as being able to apply them effectively with a patient.
Let's bring this back to the individual level, because Daniel's question is ultimately about what someone can do for themselves. If you're not in therapy, if you're just a person who thinks a lot and suspects some of those thoughts might not be helpful, what does the science say you can actually do?
There are a few things with decent evidence behind them. The first is simply developing the habit of noticing your thoughts. This sounds trivial, but most people go through their entire day without ever stepping back and observing what their mind is doing. It's like being in a movie theater your whole life without ever realizing you're watching a screen.
The moment you notice, you've already changed something.
There's a concept in psychology called metacognitive awareness, the ability to observe your own cognitive processes. It turns out to be a skill that can be developed with practice. Even just asking yourself a few times a day, "What is my mind doing right now? What thoughts are passing through?" can start building that muscle.
I've noticed that when I actually do this, the thoughts often seem kind of absurd, like my brain is just generating noise. Random worries, imagined conversations, replays of things that happened years ago.
That's a really important realization. A lot of our mental activity is just noise. The brain generates thoughts the way the heart beats. It's what it does. Not every thought deserves to be taken seriously.
Step one is notice. What's step two?
Step two is label. When you notice a thought that seems to be causing distress, give it a category. Is this catastrophizing? Is this mind reading? Is this black and white thinking? Just naming the distortion can reduce its power. There's research showing that affect labeling, putting feelings into words, actually reduces activity in the amygdala and increases activity in the prefrontal cortex.
The act of naming engages the more rational part of the brain and calms down the emotional part.
That's the basic model. It's not a clean split. The reality is messier. But as a rough framework, it holds up. And step three is to examine. Ask yourself, what's the evidence for this thought? What's the evidence against it? If a friend had this thought, what would I tell them?
I've heard that last one called the best friend technique. It's surprisingly hard to do. It's much easier to be compassionate toward a friend than toward yourself.
That asymmetry is itself a cognitive distortion, the double standard. You hold yourself to standards you'd never apply to anyone else. Just noticing that can be powerful.
What about the people who try this and it doesn't work? Someone reads about cognitive restructuring. They try to challenge their thoughts, and it just feels like arguing with themselves. The thoughts come right back.
That's a common experience, and it's one of the reasons ACT developed as an alternative. If challenging thoughts feels like a battle you keep losing, diffusion techniques might work better. Instead of arguing with the thought, you just notice it and let it be there. You might even thank your mind for the thought. There's a great line from Stephen Hayes, "Your mind is not your enemy, but you don't have to do everything it says."
That's a helpful reframe. The mind is an overeager assistant rather than an adversary.
There's also good evidence for simple behavioral activation. This comes from the behavioral side of CBT. When people are depressed or anxious, they tend to withdraw from activities that used to bring them pleasure or a sense of accomplishment. The withdrawal then reinforces the negative thoughts. It's a cycle. Behavioral activation breaks the cycle by having people schedule and engage in those activities even when they don't feel like it.
The fake it till you make it approach.
There's actually a decent evidence base for that. Action often precedes motivation, not the other way around. People think they need to feel motivated before they can act, but in reality, acting often generates the motivation.
That's counterintuitive. The whole culture tells you to follow your feelings. Do what feels right.
That advice is sometimes actively harmful. If you're depressed, what feels right is staying in bed and avoiding people. Your feelings are part of the problem, not a reliable guide to the solution.
Let's talk about the limits of this. Some thoughts are responses to real situations. If you're in a genuinely bad situation, thinking negative thoughts about it isn't a cognitive distortion. It's accurate perception.
CBT isn't about positive thinking in the sense of denying reality. It's about accurate thinking. Beck was very clear about this. The goal is not to replace negative thoughts with positive ones, but to replace distorted thoughts with more realistic ones. Sometimes the realistic thought is still negative. If you've just lost your job, the thought "this is a serious problem and I'm worried about it" is not a distortion. The thought "I'll never work again and my life is over" probably is.
The skill is distinguishing between useful negative thoughts and distorted negative thoughts.
And that's hard to do on your own, which is why therapy exists. Having an external person who can help you see your blind spots is valuable, but the self-help version can still be useful for the more obvious distortions.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier about automatic thoughts. Where do they actually come from?
This gets into the neuroscience of the default mode network. The DMN is a set of brain regions that are active when you're not focused on any particular external task. When your mind is wandering, daydreaming, ruminating about the past, or worrying about the future.
The brain is a kind of idle mode, and when it's idling, it tends to generate self-referential thoughts.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The default mode network is hyperactive in depression. People with depression show increased connectivity in the DMN and have more difficulty disengaging from it when they need to focus on external tasks. Rumination, that stuck loop of negative thinking, seems to be associated with DMN dysfunction.
The depressed brain is literally stuck in self-referential processing. It can't get out of its own head.
That's a simplification, but it captures something important. And this connects to why mindfulness meditation has shown effectiveness for depression. Mindfulness practice seems to reduce DMN activity and strengthen the brain's ability to shift out of default mode and into task-focused attention.
I've seen studies on this. Experienced meditators show different patterns of DMN activity even when they're not meditating.
It seems to be a trainable skill. The brain gets better at noticing when it's been caught in rumination and disengaging. This is neuroplasticity in action. You're literally changing the functional connectivity of your brain through practice.
Which is both inspiring and a little daunting. It means you have to actually do the practice. There's no pill that gives you the benefits of meditation without meditating.
Not yet, anyway. Though there's some interesting research on neurofeedback and brain stimulation techniques that might accelerate the process. But for now, there's no shortcut.
Let's talk about the relationship between thoughts and emotions. In the CBT model, thoughts cause emotions. Change the thought, change the feeling. But I've always found that a bit too neat. Sometimes it feels like the emotion comes first, and the thought is just a post hoc justification.
You're not wrong, and this is an active area of debate. The CBT model does emphasize the causal roles of thoughts, but it's more of an interaction than a one-way street. Emotions can certainly trigger thoughts. When you're already anxious, your brain is more likely to generate threat-related thoughts. It's a feedback loop.
It's not that thoughts cause emotions in a simple linear way. It's that thoughts and emotions are constantly influencing each other.
And behaviors are in the loop too. This is why CBT is called cognitive behavioral therapy. If you're avoiding things because of anxiety, the avoidance reinforces the anxious thoughts and feelings. Breaking the avoidance breaks the loop.
There's something almost mechanical about this model. The mind is a system with feedback loops that can get stuck in pathological patterns.
The therapist's job is to help identify where the system is stuck and what intervention might unstick it. Sometimes it's a cognitive intervention. Challenge the thought. Sometimes it's behavioral. Do the thing you're avoiding. Sometimes it's about acceptance. Stop struggling and let the thought be there while you get on with your life.
I think the acceptance piece is the hardest one for a lot of people to grasp. The idea that you can have a painful thought and just let it be there without engaging with it seems almost contradictory. If it's painful, shouldn't you try to get rid of it?
The paradox is that trying to get rid of it often makes it stronger. This is the white bear problem we talked about. The struggle itself feeds the thing you're struggling against. Acceptance breaks that cycle. It's not resignation. It's not saying the thought is true or that the situation is hopeless. It's saying, I'm not going to spend my energy fighting this thought. I'm going to let it be there and focus on what actually matters to me.
That's a very different posture toward your own mind than most people have by default. The default is to treat every thought as important and every painful thought as an emergency.
That default posture is exhausting. It's like treating every email in your inbox as urgent. Most of them aren't. Most of your thoughts aren't urgent either. They're just mental spam.
I like that. So the skill is learning to sort the spam from the legitimate correspondence.
Not even needing to sort all of it. Just recognizing that most of it is spam and not feeling obligated to open every message.
Let's bring this back to the numbers for a minute. If we have something like 6,000 thought transitions per day, and we're asleep for roughly a third of that, we're talking about 4,000 thoughts during waking hours. That's a lot of mental events. No wonder people feel overwhelmed.
Most of those thoughts are repetitive. Research suggests that a large percentage of our daily thoughts are essentially the same thoughts we had yesterday and the day before. The mind runs the same loops over and over.
Which means if you can intervene on even a small percentage of those loops, you might get a disproportionate benefit. You don't need to catch every distorted thought. Just catching a few of the most frequent ones could shift your experience significantly.
That's exactly the clinical reality. Most people in CBT don't become perfect thought catchers. They just get better at recognizing their most common patterns, the top 5 or 10 distortions that show up again and again. And that's often enough to reduce symptoms meaningfully.
What are the most common ones?
Catastrophizing is up there. Mind reading is huge. Personalization, taking responsibility for things that aren't actually your fault. Emotional reasoning, treating feelings as facts. I feel guilty, therefore I must have done something wrong. I feel worthless, therefore I must be worthless. That one is particularly pernicious.
Emotional reasoning seems like it would be hard to spot because it feels so convincing. The feeling is real, so the conclusion must be real.
This is where the empiricism piece comes in. You treat the thought as a hypothesis. I feel worthless, so I must be worthless. Okay, what's the evidence? What would count as evidence for or against that proposition? What would an objective observer say? The process forces you to step outside the feeling and look at it from a distance.
It's almost like you're running a little science experiment on your own beliefs.
That's literally what Beck intended. Collaborative empiricism. The patient and therapist are co-investigators examining the patient's thoughts as hypotheses to be tested.
That's a very different model than the stereotypical therapy where you lie on a couch and talk about your childhood.
And that's partly why CBT was controversial when it first emerged. It was structured, directive, focused on the present rather than the past. It looked more like teaching than traditional therapy. But the evidence kept accumulating, and now it's one of the most widely practiced forms of psychotherapy in the world.
There's something appealing about the idea that you can learn to think more clearly. It suggests that mental health isn't just something that happens to you. There are skills involved.
Skills can be learned. That's the hopeful message. You're not stuck with the thinking patterns you have. Your brain is plastic. Your cognitive habits are modifiable. It takes work, and it's not a cure-all, but the evidence says that for many people it helps.
By the way, I should mention, today's episode is being scripted by DeepSeek V4 Pro. There, that's out of the way.
Let's keep going.
I want to talk about something that gets overlooked in these discussions, the social dimension of thinking. We tend to talk about thoughts as if they happen in isolation, inside one person's head. But a lot of our thinking is shaped by the people around us. the thoughts that circulate in a family or a workplace or a culture.
This is a really important point. CBT has been criticized, fairly in my view, for being too focused on the individual and not sufficiently attentive to social context. If you're in an environment that is hostile or invalidating, changing your thoughts might help you cope, but it doesn't change the environment.
Some thoughts that look like cognitive distortions from the outside might actually be accurate perceptions of a bad situation. If your boss really is hostile, thinking your boss is hostile isn't mind-reading or catastrophizing. It's just accurate.
This is why good CBT always includes a reality testing component that takes context seriously. The therapist doesn't just tell the patient their thoughts are distorted, they help the patient gather evidence. Sometimes the evidence confirms that the situation really is bad, and then the focus shifts to problem solving or acceptance rather than cognitive restructuring.
That's a more nuanced picture than the caricature of CBT as just positive thinking.
The caricature is frustrating because it misses what's actually powerful about the approach. It's not about putting a happy spin on things, it's about seeing clearly. And sometimes seeing clearly means recognizing that a situation is difficult and that your negative thoughts about it are proportionate and appropriate.
There's also the question of when thinking becomes counterproductive. I can imagine someone reading about all this and then spending the next 3 months anxiously monitoring every thought that passes through their mind, which sounds exhausting and probably not helpful.
That's a real risk, and it's something good therapists watch out for. Metacognitive awareness is useful. Hypervigilance about your thoughts is not. The goal is to develop a lighter touch. You're not trying to police every thought. You're just trying to notice when you're getting caught in a pattern that you know from experience leads to suffering.
It's more like having a gentle alarm system than a surveillance state in your head.
That's a good distinction. And this connects to what's called metacognitive therapy, developed by Adrian Wells. He argues that it's not the content of thoughts that causes problems, it's the way we relate to them. The worry about worry. The rumination about rumination. His approach focuses on reducing these unhelpful thinking processes rather than challenging the content of specific thoughts.
The problem isn't having negative thoughts. It's getting stuck in a loop about having negative thoughts.
Yes, the cognitive attentional syndrome, he calls it, worry, rumination, threat monitoring, and unhelpful coping behaviors. The treatment targets the process, not the content.
That makes intuitive sense to me. Most of the time when I'm suffering mentally, it's not because of any particular thought. It's because I'm stuck in a groove that I can't get out of. The thoughts just keep cycling.
That cycling is what the default mode network does when it's dysregulated. It's a stuck record. The intervention is to help the brain unstick itself. Whether through cognitive restructuring, diffusion, mindfulness, or behavioral activation depends on the person and the context.
We've covered a lot of ground. The numbers on thoughts per day, the definitional question, the CBT model of distorted thinking, the ACT alternative, the neuroscience of the default mode network, the limits and critiques. What's the single most important thing you'd want a listener to take away from this?
I think it's this. Your thoughts are not you. They're mental events that your brain produces, and many of them are automatic, repetitive, and not particularly accurate. You don't have to believe everything you think. And learning to relate to your thoughts differently, whether through examining them or stepping back from them or both, is a skill that can meaningfully improve your life. The evidence for this is substantial, and the skills are learnable.
That's well put. The "your thoughts are not you" piece feels like the foundation everything else rests on. Once you've had that insight, even briefly, it changes something. You can't unsee it.
That insight is available to anyone. You don't need a therapist to have it, though a therapist can certainly help you deepen it and apply it consistently. But the basic realization that you are not identical with your thoughts, that you can observe your thoughts from a distance, is something you can discover just by paying attention.
I think that's a good place to land. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
The world's largest collection of banana-related items is held by a man named Kenneth Bannister from California, who as of 2023 owned over 20,000 banana-themed objects, including banana-shaped telephones, banana costumes, and a banana-flavored soda can collection spanning 43 countries.
For the listener who's been following along and wants to do something with this, where do you start? I think the simplest entry point is just to pick one time of day. Maybe right before bed or during your commute, and spend 2 minutes asking yourself what thoughts were running through my mind today, and were any of them distorted. Just that tiny bit of self-observation can start building the metacognitive muscle.
I'd add that if you want something more structured, there are evidence-based apps now. Wobot is one that's been studied in randomized trials. It delivers CBT-based interventions through a chatbot interface. It's not a replacement for therapy, but the research suggests it can reduce symptoms of depression and anxiety for some people. There's also MoodKit and CBTI Coach for insomnia. These are tools that put the principles we've been discussing into a format you can use on your own.
If you prefer books, David Burns' Feeling Good is basically the classic self-help translation of CBT. It's been around since the 1980s, and it's still widely recommended. For the ACT perspective, Russ Harris's The Happiness Trap is a good starting point.
One thing I want to emphasize is that if you're dealing with serious depression, anxiety, or trauma, self-help has limits. The evidence is clear that for moderate to severe conditions, working with a trained therapist produces better outcomes than self-help alone. There's no shame in that. It's like the difference between stretching at home and seeing a physical therapist for an injury. Both have their place.
The question Daniel asked at the beginning was whether learning to control your thoughts can lead to a happier life. I think the answer from the science is a qualified yes. No control in the sense of suppression or domination, but in the sense of skillful relationship. Learning to see thoughts clearly, to question them when they're distorted, to let them pass when they're not useful, and to focus attention on what actually matters. That's not a magic bullet, but it's a real thing that real people can learn to do.
The qualification matters. It's not about achieving a state of perfect mental hygiene where no negative thought ever arises. That's not possible, and it's not the goal. The goal is to suffer less and live more fully, to not be pushed around by every thought that passes through your mind.
I think that's a good note to end on. Thanks to Daniel for the prompt. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this whole operation running. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long-eared host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.